Welcome to episode 4 of the Women in the Can competition season of the Seventh Row podcast. I'm your host, Alda Smith, the executive editor of Seventh Row. This year is the first year that Can has put 5 films directed by women in competition, more than any previous year. They're still far from gender parity, but we wanted to take this opportunity to celebrate the wonderful women filmmakers and their films that have been feted by the competition, both this year and in the past. This week we're going to talk about a sort of under-discussed Cannes darling, Naomi Kawase, the Japanese filmmaker, who is one of the filmmakers who has been programmed by Cannes the most this century, just underneath the Dardenne brothers and Ken Loach. She's been programmed by the festival 6 times this century, and many of those were in competition. It's a rarity for women directors. The next underneath her are Andrea Arnold, Nicole Garcia, and Mai Wen, who have been programmed 3 times this century. It's also partially because Naomi Kawase is one of few female filmmakers who actually makes films semi-regularly. It's a rarity for women who are often not given funding and support to continuously make their art on a schedule that we all would like. And yet, as we will discuss in this episode, Kawase has this weird reputation where, despite the fact that she's so regularly programmed by Cannes, her films are often ridiculed when they're at the festival. We're going to go into a lot of instances of that ridicule in this episode and talk about the kind of blatant sexism that underlies it. We think she's a particularly interesting filmmaker who's doing some notable work that shouldn't necessarily have been as easily dismissed as it has been in the past, for the reasons that it has been in the past. She's also kind of significant to this year's Cannes because she recently directed the recent Tokyo Olympics official film, which screened at the festival this year. Now, we've talked in previous episodes in this series about this being the final episode, but we were lying. We have a secret surprise 5th episode coming next week, in which we're going to do kind of a recap of Cannes 2022, because we realised that we have a bunch to say, not just because we've actually seen a bunch of films by women that screened at Cannes this year in the sidebars, and we want to talk about them, but also because the festival has predictably fucked up in a myriad ways this year, and we want to kind of recap that and hold it accountable in an entertaining way. So tune in next Wednesday for that. In the meantime, you can listen back to episode 1 of this series, in which we sort of go over a history of women at Cannes, episode 2, in which we talk about Kelly Reichardt and her relationship with Cannes, and episode 3, where we talk about Celine Sayama and her relationship with Cannes. Also, to remind you, accompanying this series, we are selling a Cannes Women in the Cannes competition box set of ebooks that we have written in the past about women who have screened in the Cannes competition. So that contains 3 ebooks, one about Celine Sayama's work called Portraits of Resistance, one about Kelly Reichardt's work, we're called Roads to Nowhere, and we have a book about Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here. So if you're interested in those filmmakers, go to 7th-row.com/women-at-cannes-box-set and you can get yourself a copy. So if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you might wonder why it's just me talking. I usually am accompanied by our editor-in-chief, Alex Heaney, and a guest or two. And the reason is, what you're actually about to hear is a bit of an old episode that we've revamped for the purposes of this season. In early 2021, we recorded an episode about Naomi Kawase's career to celebrate the release of her film True Mothers, which we really loved. And it was a conversation that really went deep on the misogynistic reception of a lot of her films and her relationship to Cannes and the strange reception she's had at the festival. So we wanted to bring that episode back, and the majority of this episode, after I finish talking, is going to be, you're going to hear from me, you're going to hear from Alex, you're going to hear from our associate editor, Brett Pardy, and you're going to hear from a special guest, Millie Gribben, and actually I'm going to play little section of introduction that she gave herself on the episode right now, because she's not someone that we've had on this season so far. So she deserves a little bit of an introduction. So here's Millie.
So you might have seen me on Seventh Row, written a couple of little bits. And as all will know, I studied film at Uni of Leeds, and I wrote my dissertation on Kelly Reichardt, which was a labour of love. But yeah, it was on kind of like queerness and isolation in her films. And yeah, I haven't seen Certain Women in a very long time, but I love it. And I think that, yeah, she's just a brilliant director. So
that was Millie. And so back to my little preamble here. So obviously, being over a year old, this episode is slightly dated. A few little correction things. We mentioned Jane Campion being the only woman to have won the Palme d'Or in this episode. That is no longer true. Just a few months after we recorded the original episode, Julia Ducournau won the Palme d'Or for Titane. So good for her. Now it's a grand total of two. We also talk about the inaccessibility of Kwasi's films, which is still true for a large majority of them. She's made a lot of films and a lot of them are nowhere to be found. However, gladly, a lot of her films have been added to the Criterion channel just a few months ago. So you can find films like True Mothers and Still the Water on there, which is great. Also, like I mentioned before, since this episode was recorded, there's been a new Kwasi film, which is her Tokyo Olympics film. And we have now seen that film, so it's not mentioned in this episode, but you can tune in for next week's episode about Cannes 2022, and we'll be talking about it then. Okay, so there's a last thing that I want to talk about before we get onto this episode, and it's something I'm not totally sure how to address at this point, but it feels important to acknowledge. Recently, really in the past week, there's been rising talk that I'm personally seeing on Twitter, on social media, about accusations of, I'd say, violence, abusive behaviour on set of Naomi Kwasi. And obviously that's a very fraught thing to hear about a director that you really love and admire, especially as you're gearing up to release / re-release a podcast episode in which you're fawning over her. I don't really want to give my own description of all the various accusations that have been levelled against her. I am going to leave a Twitter thread in the description of this episode, in the show notes, that you can look over yourself. It includes sort of a timeline of accusations and some evidence. So it's all there to peruse for yourself. And it's something, you know, that is really important to keep in mind as you listen to this episode. And as we talk about how Kwasi has been perceived throughout her career and treated throughout her career, we talk a lot about how she's really, like, her work has been mistreated and viewed in a misogynistic, racist way by mainstream critical bodies, and how a lot of the very real nuances and intelligent choices in her filmmaking have been overlooked for those reasons and misconstrued and not taken seriously, and the types of stories that she tells, particularly about young women, haven't been taken seriously. I do strongly believe that that is still an important conversation to have, even if now I think the altruism and even the safety of Kwasi as a person to be on set with is coming into question. This whole season about women at Cannes has really been about, as well as celebrating the women who have screened at Cannes and who have made interesting art, it's been about holding Cannes accountable and also sort of holding misogynistic structures in the film industry and the way films by and about women are perceived at festivals like Cannes and by critics who go to Cannes, holding that accountable. And I think that's a lot of what this episode is about. It's about Naomi Kwasi as a case study for how women and women of colour are treated. And institutions like this is so instructive of the things that we have been talking about and beyond our opinions of Kwasi as a filmmaker and as a person. Those structures still exist to hinder filmmakers, well, to hinder her and to hinder filmmakers like her and who work in a similar world and vein and interests as her. It's really important to talk about those structures, and this is, I think, a really rich discussion about those structures. Because let me tell you, when white male critics from IndieWire were complaining about Cannes even programming Naomi Kawase in the first place, they were not trying to provoke a nuanced discussion about violent, aggressive, and potentially harmful behaviour on set. Because if they were, maybe they would be more concerned about filmmakers like Roman Polanski and David O. Russell being programmed in major festivals. But I don't think they are. Anyway, that's been a kind of strange and awkward addendum to this conversation. I just wanted to give you some information that I think is important to know about the filmmaker we're going to be talking about, even though I think this conversation is valuable, even quite apart from Kwasi herself as a filmmaker. And it's just important to know that as you hear us speak, that is not information that we had. And with that out of the way, I'm just going to play the rest of this episode, and I'll see you at the very end for the outro. Enjoy.
So yeah, I don't know, Brett, do you want to try and give us some background on Naomi Kawase?
No,
like,
so...
No, why are you asking me?
Does she fit in any way with your doctor empathy studies?
I mean, I suppose she does. Like, there's a TED Talk where she describes her approach to filmmaking, and she talks about film as being important in terms of like kind of capturing time. Like, she feels that time passes by, but by putting it on film, it's a way to be able to share it with other people.
I think she said also that it almost gives you the ability to rewind time.
And I think you see that a lot of her films are very concerned with the inevitability of time passing. Relevant to True Mothers, it seems she was adopted. She's from a rural area of Japan, which is not usually seen on kind of the Japanese films that cross over to a Western audience.
And I think where the place she's from, Nara, is where, it's definitely where Shara is set. I'm not sure about any of her other films, but she's set a lot of her films in like rural Japan, if not specifically there.
And she's definitely one of the more prolific women directors. Like, she's been making films in some form since 1988. She started off making like short films and video art, and then moved into narrative film like in the late 90s. And it seems her background is in, she went to the Osaka School of Photography, and it seems like her background is very informed by photography as much as kind of filmmaking. And so I think sometimes we'll talk about this in a bit on the podcast, people complain about her camera choices, and I think it's partly because like it's a camera choice, they're camera choices that make sense in photography setting that maybe aren't kind of the standard camera choices of Western filmmaking. In Radiance, one of the main characters is a photographer who is losing his sight.
I mean, I guess it's worth commenting that she's sort of a Cannes darling. Her first feature, Suzaku, in 1997, it won the Camera d'Or, and I guess she was the youngest person to have ever won that.
Really? Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she would have been 28.
Has Javier Dolan never won the Camera d'Or? It feels like he would have enjoyed beating that record.
No, he has not.
But, and then she won the Grand Prix for The Morning Forest. But her films get consistently programmed at Cannes. I think basically everything has premiered at Cannes, which is a pretty strong track record compared to other filmmakers, because even Cannes darlings like Mike Lee don't always get accepted. I'm trying to think what Ken Loach film wasn't accepted, but I don't think he's always programmed.
It's close to that.
Although, like, I don't know how tied that is with Cannes, like, consistent inability to program female directors in the competition. Have they just sort of been like, well, this is the one woman that we're always going to accept so that we meet that, so that we have like at least some women in the competition?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. And I think most of her films have played in competition. Sweet Bean, I think, is one of the rare films that was programmed in A Certain Regard, and I think there was degree of discussion at the time because Still the Water was in competition the year before, and it got panned by a lot of critics, or at least like middling reviews. And so then there was some discussion of like, was Sweet Bean, like her putting it in Certain Regard, like her punishment. I mean, it was the opening film of it, but that's usually like, it's happened more since, but generally, like, you at some point, you start out in Certain Regard, which is more for earlier career filmmakers, and at some point you graduate to competition. So then it's a big to-do if, like, you had been in competition all the time and suddenly you were in a Certain Regard. Like, that happened with Corita. What was the film?
After the Storm?
That's the one, I think, that was in a Certain Regard.
And she was on the jury in 2013.
Oh, okay.
A fun jury, including Steven Spielberg, Ong Lee, Nicole Kidman, Lynn Ramsey, and Christoph Waltz.
Wow, well, that's a room I'd be interested to be in. I think it could be interesting to talk about how we were all sort of either like the circumstances under which we first watched her films or how we were introduced to her. Especially because she is kind of a contentious figure, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's worth commenting on, because I did say she's at Cannes all the time, but it's actually really hard to find her films, or was until recently.
I mean, True Mothers is a rare case where it's a film that has actually kind of gained distribution in North America.
And I think Sweet Bean is the most widely accessible film, whereas, like, Still the Water completely disappeared.
Yeah. Well, I think the first time I heard of her was one of the years she was in Cannes, one of the many years she was in Cannes, and I believe it was Radiance in 2017. And I wasn't super aware of her before, but I was paying attention to the Cannes lineup that year and sort of like perusing Twitter as you do, and a lot of like I think the other two female directors in competition were Marinard for Tony Erdman and Andrea Arnold for American Honey, and going into the festival, so this is before the film even premiered, I just remember like very kind of high profile male critics, particularly like in places like The Guardian, you know, The Telegraph, like name places, just like making fun of her. And that was my introduction to Naomi Kawase, was like as a joke of like, I can't believe they keep programming this terrible filmmaker in Cannes. And I didn't really have any context for it at the time, but I guess in my brain, well, I think something about it always did seem off, just because I was at the time sort of frustrated by how few female directors there were in competition. But I sort of did write her off in my head, I guess, as like, oh, she's a director people don't like. And the first film of hers I actually saw was True Mothers, mainly because there wasn't really a way for me to see any of her other films that had premiered since. And I really loved True Mothers. And then I was really glad to be able to do this. And I watched basically all of her films and rewatched True Mothers, not all of them, but the ones that we were watching for this podcast this week. And it's been a super interesting week. I think we're going to have a lot to talk about, because even her films that are misses, or I mean, I wouldn't even call them misses, even her films that are less good than others are interesting. And the larger conversation of her body of work is really interesting to me. And some of them are, I think, are really great. What's everyone else's introduction to her?
For me, this, to be honest, was my introduction. I'd heard of her a little bit. I think it was like 2018. I'd said, like, I want to watch more films by female directors. And I'd done a thing on Twitter where I'd kind of said, like, could people give me recommendations? And I got quite a lot. And I think maybe Still the Water was in there. So I kind of went, okay, that's interesting. Never heard of her. And obviously it took me this long to actually watch her films. But I think that's probably, again, because they're not that necessarily that easy to, you know, access. So it's been an interesting couple of weeks of discovering her work. Yeah, and as you say, I don't the quality definitely varies, but viewing them like in this, you know, as a kind of collective of films has been really, really interesting. Yeah, I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I remember one of the first conversations I had with Alex was about who is Naomi Kawase, because I was interested, we were talking about programming and how there's no woman at Cannes, but I was interested in who's this one woman who's programmed at Cannes all the time, and why are her films impossible to track down? This is probably in like 2013, 2014.
Oh, wow. Have we known each other that long? That's
And then when did you first watch one of her films?
I think maybe like a year or two after that. Mm-hmm. Watched Morning Forest, I think. And I saw Radiance when it came out at TIFF that year.
Well, and I remember you persuaded me to see Vision the next year at TIFF. Your recommendation was, I like the way she shoots trees.
She's the best director of trees.
I was like, okay, I'm sold.
Mm-hmm. Alex, what was your introduction?
Yeah, so I guess my introduction was like at the eye of the storm. The first time I went to Cannes was in 2014, and that was when Still the Water premiered. And that year, Jane Campion was the jury president, and she is the only or one of two women to win the Palme d'Or.
Only, and she shared the palm that year.
Right. So people were sort of, there was a discussion, I think, I don't know if it was for the first time, but it was quite a prominent discussion about the lack of women at Cannes generally, but especially in competition. And I think, does anyone know what her statement was about that? Because I think she made a statement in the opening press conference with the jury.
Yeah, so Jane Campion just sort of, and it was a big deal at the time, gave, when she was a jury president, gave a impassioned speech about how she called the studio structure an old boys system, and sort of said, she said, I don't think women grew up with the world of criticism that men grew up with, and was just talking about how like film schools have equal numbers of men and women, and then that doesn't seem to translate into the film industry. And I feel like more people, like, I mean, it was, as you said, Alex, kind of a sort of novel thing that she was like commenting on this.
Yeah, it's funny because it doesn't seem novel now, but it really was then.
Yeah, like reading that back, it doesn't seem inflammatory in the same way that I think people were really threatened by that at the time. It felt like that she was saying something new, when now, like reading it from the perspective of like 7 years later, it feels like, people say this all the time, but not in 2014, apparently.
Yeah, I don't think there had been a lot of jury presidents that were women. I can't remember now.
Mm. And I guess it was sort of bold of her to sort of speak out against the festival that she was heading that year.
Yeah.
Especially as one of the only women that they'd actually let into the club.
Yes. Yeah, so I guess that was the context in which I saw the film. And I had never heard of Naomi Kawase, and I think I was like relatively new to film Twitter. This was like the first time I was at a festival with the deluge of film Twitter responses. And
was this Louder Than Bombs year?
No, that was the next year.
Okay.
So anyway, so I didn't know anything about Naomi Kawase. I didn't know what to expect. And I was like, well, it's one of the two women in competition, so I'm going to see it. And now I'm trying to piece together what my response to it was, because I remember not liking it. Although I remember liking a lot of things about it, but then finding it a bit overwrought and the characters a bit thin. And I just like revisited the review that I wrote, Baby Me wrote. Baby, I was like 25, but whatever. And it's very bizarre because it's like the whole review sounds like I really like it until the last paragraph where I crab all over it. So I don't know what was going on with me then. My theory now is that, like, I mean, obviously as a site, as a publication, we really like character-driven films. That's obviously something that I care a lot about, and that, I mean, that's still primarily what I look for in a film, but I think especially because I had no context for her filmmaking, I was looking for that in her film and didn't find it.
Mm.
So I think that kind of turned me off. I think when I rewatched it this time, I had a different experience because I think I had a better sense of her preoccupations, her interests, her style, and so had a better sense of more generally what the film was doing. And it, like, I didn't necessarily need to have really complex character development in it. Like, I could appreciate the other things, whereas I think I didn't really understand that that's what I should be looking for when I saw it back then.
Mm. And then you slept through Sweet Bean.
I didn't sleep through the whole, okay, but it was the opening night film of Un Certain Regard, and there was this opening ceremony that lasted for like an hour, and I was really, really tired when I went into the screening at like 8 p.m. and thought maybe I should go to bed instead of going to the movie. But I was like, no, I want to try out her next film, maybe I'll like this one. But then by the time the movie finally started at like 9 p.m. I was ready for bed. So, and her films are so like relaxing and calming.
Mm-hmm.
that, yeah, I slept through a big chunk of it. Yeah, and so then I kind of, well, I guess she, what was her next film was Radiance. So mm-hmm. I guess I missed that because I thought, well, I guess I don't really like her. But then Brett liked it, and then I thought, oh, well, maybe I should check it out. And then obviously I saw Vision at Brett's recommendation, and then I think True Mothers was the first film of hers that I really, really loved because I feel like it combines both the more the sort of like imagery and all of those ideas that are in her other films, but it also has really, really strong character development.
I was just about to say it, and maybe Sweet Bean are the character films for you.
Yeah. Which is not to say that I don't like the other films. Like, I think basically what you said, Orla, that I think they're always interesting. Like, I was really glad I saw Vision, especially now that it's disappeared, because I agree with Brett. I really like how she shot trees. Unfortunately, that's most of what I remember about
honestly,
the film.
Honestly, it's most of what I remember about. There's something about mushrooms, too, but...
I think Juliette Binoche has an affair with an older mm-hmm. Japanese man.
I mean, Juliette Binoche is good, as she always is.
Yeah, but I remember nothing about her aside from that she went to a forest.
She's really in tune with the trees, though, when she gets there. There's like a scene where the leaves are swirling around her.
Like in Still the Water, the way that when the protagonist's mother is like, is sort of dying and this seemingly like spirit of her mother comes to, you know, enters the room, and that idea of like family connections being so much like they last beyond death, and they don't, they're very malleable actually, like they kind of shift. And yeah, I think that's one aspect. I think why I liked viewing her films as this kind of whole was you can see the way that there's something really moving about her approach to like family connections. And I think knowing that she was adopted actually like is just completely changes the way I look at her films. I'm like, oh wow, yeah. Okay. You know.
Yeah. And the fact that her career kind of started making these personal documentaries about her family, about her adoption. And so the fact that even if the text of the films isn't adoption like it is with True Mothers, there's always a sense that she's actively thinking about and questioning like what family means, what family bonds mean, you know, what it means to be like a parent or a mother in a way that's not just like falling back to the default of what society thinks that means.
It's a more of like an open view of it.
And I think those like her tendency towards dual protagonists and also like absences, there's this idea of sort of alternative lives. Like often the characters are diametrically opposed, like the man who's going blind and the woman who creates the audio descriptions, like they're on completely opposite sides of that transaction.
In Radiance.
And in The Morning Forest you have two people who are grieving, one who's grieving his wife who died at an old age and one who's grieving her child who died as a baby. And so you know, I mean, they're both dealing with grief, but one is about the loss of a full life and one is about the life that wasn't lived.
And then in Sweet Bean, you have a lady who can make good bean paste and a man who can make good pancakes. A lady who loves to make bean paste and a man who does not have a sweet bean. Which are really the true opposites.
Yeah. But I mean, and I think this came out especially in Still the Water, that you have like one family that's very close and one family that's broken. And that sort of, I wonder to what degree that's kind of like, well, what would it have been like had I lived with my birth mother? I mean, this is like me projecting a little bit, but I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, that's part of why True Mothers is interesting, because it tells its narrative is both before and after the birth for both characters. And the idea that the birth mother's life, like her story doesn't end just because the baby has changed hands, and her life, it's not as though she can just forget that she gave up the child. Even if like ultimately I'm not sure she would have decided to keep it if she had the time to choose, but like her parents kind of took that decision out of her hands, which is part of why it was traumatic, is like she didn't even get the opportunity to think it through and go, okay, yeah, you're right, that's probably the best thing for me. Yeah, I feel like a lot of the time when we talk about adoption, we think of it as like, well, they didn't want the child and so they can give it up and then they can you know, live their life, or like somebody who like lives with the regret. And I don't think she necessarily lives with regret for giving up. Well, I don't know, I mean, she does eventually say she wants it back, but I don't know if she lives with regret from it, but it's not as though it just is empty from her, has like been removed from her life. It was still like a formative experience, and part of the trauma for her is not having lost the baby, but well, that sounds like it died, but
It's an unresolved
mystery. And especially the fact that then everybody, her whole family wants to act like it didn't happen, so she can't talk about it to anybody. And the silence around it is traumatizing, and she's, like, depressed because of this. Yeah. And, like, she's gone through this, you know, like, a pretty big physical experience, quite apart from, like, the emotional part of it, and then she has to act like it never happened.
Mm. It definitely is a bit like, and you brought this film up a bit earlier, Alex, a film that we talked about 2 episodes ago, which we saw at Berlin, called Ninja Baby, which is a really good look at a woman who has to carry out a pregnancy of a child that she doesn't want. And it does deal very well, as this film does, with, like, the idea of, like, even if you don't then become, like, the, like, literal, like, the mother of the child that you carry, in the sense that you're parenting them every day and they live with you, whether you wanted to keep the child or not is, like, you know, an intimate experience with this thing that has lived inside you. And it's also possible to, like, have a relationship with, and, like, can be healthy to have a relationship with that child, even if you aren't, like, their parent. Which I think, I mean, I like that the film ends on an ambiguous note. It kind of leaves you to think about, like, what might happen next. But there's a sense that there's an acceptance between the two mothers that they can both be in the child's life, even though that might be a thing that, like, society considers taboo, or at least doesn't have, like, a rule book for.
Well, and I also think it's interesting that the circumstance of the child's creation is not traumatic. Like, it's a and you wonder how much, like, how much of the fact that she got pregnant was also, like, did she have sex, like, did she know about contraception? Because they're talking about how she, you know, she hasn't even had her period, how could she get pregnant, she's very young. So if there was silence around that, that's kind of like what would have allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. But, like, the boy is very sweet and they really care for each other. So,
and obviously, like, he can't handle, like, what happened. Yeah. But he's also, like, a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah. I mean, she can't really handle it either. She just doesn't have a choice.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's, you know, it's still a sort of consensual, I mean, relatively for 14 years old, but anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But it's you know, it's not a really traumatic pregnancy, but it still is, right? Like, I think that's what that shows really effectively, is motherhood is hard, like, even if it's an active decision that you're making.
Yeah, and it's not like her parents throw her out, but their reaction is still traumatic. Like, I think they mean well, but they're also,
they don't know how to deal with it either.
And the way, and out of sight, out of mind, like, for them, they can, it's a lot easier for them to deal, to act like it didn't happen, because they sent her away. They didn't see her get super pregnant and give birth. Which made me think a lot about, like, whenever this is, like, what, a month ago now, we had that discussion about motherhood and horror, and how motherhood is still very much a private experience that happens behind closed doors. And I thought this is a film that's really quite interesting because it goes behind those doors and it talks about the secrecy behind that.
Yeah, it was interesting because Naomi Kawase's films are all very beautiful, but they, I mean, I think he's told me, Alex, that they don't all have cinematographer.
I mean, some of them have, like, she might have worked with the same cinematographer for a couple of films, but she's worked with a bunch of.
Yeah, it feels like it is, like, the Naomi Kawase look rather than, like, whatever cinematographer she's working with, like, bends to the Naomi Kawase look, which is, like, incredibly sort of, I don't know how I describe it. Incredibly, like, beautiful lighting, natural lighting.
It's almost like unnaturally natural lighting. Right. Like, I don't know how to explain it. Like, because you're very aware of the light, but
the sun is a huge presence in her films. Yeah. And it's, I mean, in pretty much every single one of her films, nature is a huge presence. Her films kind of, like, seem to be almost, like, adoring of nature, which makes sense in the sense that she grew up in rural Japan, in kind of, like, the countryside. But, like, as Brett has said, she shoots trees like no one else. And, yeah, it is interesting. Like,
it's also handheld.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And sometimes the handheld, like, it's not necessarily handheld in close-up. Like, sometimes she gets really close to the characters and you feel their hair.
Yeah, I mean, it,
and, like, you feel like you're close to their skin, and at other times she's observing them from afar.
Yeah. I mean, there was a quote in her TED Talk, which I wrote down, actually, where she said, And a principle that guides her films is that she believes there is nothing more powerful than the emotions we share. And her films are about sharing emotions. And I think that that is very present in the visual style of, like, everything is very beautiful. And with the handheld, we get often quite close to characters. The camera feels very intimate. And the camera feels very in tune with the characters and their emotions, rather than taking like a more kind of objective, removed perspective.
It feels like she has a lot she has a lot of love for her characters. I mean, you would hope every filmmaker does, but it feels like unique. It's just a real fondness and a desire to sort of. I think she talks about in the TED Talk, there was something about time passing through everyone at the same speed and like trying to capture that and stay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's such like a sort of gentleness to how she stays with these people. Even though, you know, for a lot of it, there's very little incident. And, you know, I know some people maybe don't enjoy that style of storytelling, but I really admire it.
They tend to be nice people. Like, her films are about, like, it's just like they're always, there aren't really nasty people in her films. You know, like, there might be somebody who says something nasty.
The people who mean well.
At one point, but then you understand that, like, they're just hurting. And they feel badly about
it. There
are
no villains.
Like everybody's just kind of trying their best and they're caring for other people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that stands out most in the male characters, really, because it goes against what we usually see. Because, I mean, it really stands out in True Mothers, like how sensitively she depicts the husband character.
Yeah.
In Still the Water, the girl's father is just so lovely. And even the boy's father, who's a more like absent, problematic figure, is still like
likable in some ways.
Yeah, like he's like depicted. He's very warm. He's depicted empathetically. Like we do understand like why his son looks up to him, for example. And we understand him to be a person who is perhaps trying to do good.
Especially in his relationship with his father, there's a lot of physical intimacy in that relationship. Like, we see them at a bathhouse together, washing each other. We see him on the back of his father's motorcycle, which is contrasted with the image of his girlfriend riding on the back of his bike. And there's like sort of an intimacy to that. And you see a real physical closeness with his father, which is contrasted with the fact that he has to take a plane to get there and that his father is physically distant, and going into Tokyo means there's highways and loud sounds, which are very different from the calm of where he lives. And contrasted with his relationship with his mother, which is like loving but kind of distant, like you see them in different rooms of the house and he sort of, there's a lot of him overhearing her or watching her from afar, but not a lot of them talking to each other. Like, she's always away working, and so he gets notes from her, or, you know, he sees her in passing. And even the fact that when she picks him up from the airport, she's driving a car, so they're not as close as when he was on the back of his father's motorcycle.
We learned that Sentaro, who runs the dorayaki shop, like, been in prison. This is like one of the only jobs he can get.
He's banished to a life of making pancakes.
Yeah, when he has no sweet tooth. But like
the worst punishment.
But like, it's very empathetic to introduce him to us for quite a bit before we learn that's why he's there.
Right.
Yeah, we meet him on his own terms. And I think that's the thing. Like, her films are very uncynical about the world and about their characters. I mean, I could see a version of True Mothers where, like, for example, Hikari having sex with the boy who gets her pregnant could be like from a filmmaker who was more removed from their characters, depicted as sort of like, oh, aren't they silly for doing this? But she wants us to be kind of with her characters and with like, and her depiction of young love in Still the Water as well is similar. Even though we as like adult audiences understand that there's like a certain fickleness to young love, she takes their emotions in the moment very seriously and very sincerely.
Yeah. It's definitely like very idealized depictions of it. Like, these are not kids who have clumsy sex. but that's like kind of fine because it's about, as you said, Orla, like they're, like to them, it's a really big emotional deal, and it treats that with respect, even if it also is like, you just had sex and it's perfect, and you, it was such an emotional and beautiful experience,
and it wasn't painful to Which have like- sex on the forest floor.
Oh my god, that's all I could think about. Like,
they didn't even put a towel down. That looks really
uncomfortable. She must have sticks poking into her back. Anyway,
oh dear,
it does ruin that scene slightly.
I wonder if the kind of sincerity of it is maybe why, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons why some critics have sort of, you know, taken against, you know, misogyny maybe and racism. But anyway, I'm not going to say, not every critic, hashtag not all critics. But like, you know, I think when things are really sincere, it's easy to mock them and to kind of go, well, you know, especially when it is the subject, when the subject is young women as well, I think it's kind of easy to say, well, this is so saccharine and this is so like overly sincere. And I don't know, just watching these films, I just kind of was like, I admire that. It's not normally the kind of thing that I would go for, but you are almost sort of trained by the way that she depicts these lives to kind of buy into it and to value that.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that in Radiance, one of the main themes is that there's kind of emotions you can see that when you translate into words sound very saccharine. And I was like, that is very reflective on her career, because I do think a lot of times maybe some of the dialogue in her films is quite saccharine. I mean, I don't know if that's a translation issue sometimes too. But,
Maybe.
I think it's probably both.
Yeah, but in Radiance, the line that they keep coming back to is, nothing is more beautiful than that which has just disappeared. Like, I understand that visually, but then, like, it does sound kind of like greeting cardish saccharine if you say it out loud, but I think can be quite an affecting thing to see.
Yeah.
Her films deal with really kind of, like, really deep subjects of, like, so many of her films are about loss in some way. And coming to terms with loss. So it's not like she's really like this feel-good director necessarily.
No.
But she dares to take like the depth of those feelings seriously and portray them sincerely, which is, I think, something that some people, I guess, are uncomfortable with accepting.
I think it's partly that gentleness. It's sort of like if you think about Local Hero, like it's kind of a sad film, but it's so sweet. You know, like it just loves its characters, and it's so warm that it's still a feel good movie, even if like it's not necessarily a happy ending for anyone.
But I think another thing about her films, regarding like the possibly misogynistic critiques of them, I'm using very measured language, but the idea of like Still the Water in particular, it's a film that I do find it quite successfully poetic, like poetic in its imagery, poetic in its sound, in a way that I really, really love. And you see a lot of criticisms at the time calling it like trying too hard to be poetic. And it is interesting that, like, I mean, if the film that won the Palme d'Or 3 years before that film was at Cannes was like The Tree of Life, for example, I think it's really interesting. I think it's really interesting to compare the reception of like Terrence Malick's work, who has made some great films, but also has made like a lot of duds recently that some people inexplicitly still love.
Mystic duds.
And the idea of people like loving Malick and like hating Kwasi.
It seems very strange to me. I mean,
yeah,
they're like kind of on the same wavelength, just kind of different philosophies.
And, like, they both kind of revere.
And she exoticizes Japan, apparently. It's just, like, gets Christianity.
But they both, like, revere nature in their cinematography. They both have kind of very sort of poetic image-making. And when he does it in, I mean, I feel like The Tree of Life is, like, even less sort of like grounded and character oriented than like Still the Water, but it's considered like, this is an Oscar nominee, we're gonna give it the Palme d'Or, it's a masterpiece. And then when Kwasi does it 3 years later, it's trying too hard to be poetic rather than being poetic. And it's very interesting what films are considered trying too hard to be a thing versus actually being the thing.
And Complaint, she doesn't understand the visual language of the medium.
Well, and also like Tree of Life is very obviously like a Lubezki film, or Chivo, as his friends call him. But like, as we were saying before, I feel like when you watch a Kawase film, it's like, oh, it's kind of like what Agnieszka Holland said to me when I interviewed her, which is sort of like, you can probably like manipulate my cinematographer into doing what I want. And all my films have sort of similar qualities of light, but like it matters to me who my editor is and who my camera operator is. And I kind of feel like Naomi Kawase probably like kind of manipulates her cinematographer in a similar way, in the sense that...
Or at least say like, come on board, no. Going like, I know how I'm gonna make this look because it's Naomi Kawase.
Yeah, because all her films immediately look like Naomi Kawase films in a way that like Chivo's films look like Chivo's films, whether he's making them with like Alfonso Cuarón or Terrence Malick. I mean, obviously they also have like a Cuaronian character and a Malickian character, but they are like, they're like, yeah, Chivo shot that.
Although, yeah, I'd say that the New World is maybe less so with that. That's
oh, did he shoot that?
Yeah,
too?
Yeah, that's kind of more like, that's kind of more in line with Terrence Malick's other three prior films to that, which I think all had different cinematographers.
Oh, interesting.
So I think Malick does have a strong look that he's trying to achieve. Well, actually, his first film had three different cinematographers. His second film had two, and The Thin Red Line had one.
We have created a special box set of books that we previously wrote about women who have featured in the Cannes competition. The Women in Cannes competition box set includes books about three women directors who have been selected for the competition over the years. There are also three of our favourite filmmakers, Lynn Ramsey, Celine Sciamma, and this year, Kelly Reichardt. Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. That's C-A-N-N-E-S. On our Kelly Reichardt ebook, Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams, Claudio Alves of The Film Experience said, "As a Kelly Reichardt fan, I can't recommend Roads to Nowhere enough." On our Celine Sciamma book, Portraits of Resistance, film critic Alfred Soto commented, "Erudite and casual, Portraits of Resistance will force readers into running back to watch every Sciamma film to see what they missed." On our Lynn Ramsey book, You Were Never Really Here, A Special Issue, Brian Tallarico of RogerEbert.com wrote, "Seventh Row's ebook allows for a deeper appreciation of a brilliant piece of art. It's what we want more from critical analysis, a conversation with the art and its creators, but so rarely get." Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes.
But we should also talk about the sound and the films.
Yeah, we should.
Which I think is just as important as to like her aesthetic, quote unquote. Than as the images are. I know like that just as much as like she reveres nature and the images, like she reveres nature and the sounds. And I mean, I think the best example of this is Still the Water.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about when I interviewed Francis Lee about Ammonite, and I was thinking about something he said to me all the way throughout Still the Water. He said that he wanted the sound of waves lapping up against the shore to be basically audible in every single scene of that film, say for like two key moments, because, and he was talking about how the sound of the sea is like a very powerful sound to him, and also like a frightening sound, because even though it can be very calming and relaxing, it also kind of makes you think about time passing by. Mm. And like the inevitability, like the fact that time is just constantly passing by with each wave. And you hear the waves throughout most of Still the Water too. And it's a really a film like about kind of cycles of life and death. And there's literally a character who is sort of slowly moving towards the end of her life in the film. And the sort of ever presence of that wave sound was very powerful in that sense, I think.
Well, and the transition between time periods in True Mothers is usually signaled with the sound of water. The way you see the sea and hear the sound of it.
Yeah.
I mean, also, like, we're talking about wind and the trees, like, she really does capture the sound of leaves rustling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it means, like, her films all have, like, such a great sense of place. Yeah. Because she makes sure that we're hearing all the sounds of the environment, and she makes sure that we see, like, we really, like, see all of the environment. Like, I remember there's a shot in Still the Water where they have, like, a whole conversation about this, like, amazing tree in, like, the... the dying mother's back garden that she wants to be able mm-hmm. to see from her bed. And we get to know like the specific pieces of nature around them. And then we cut away to another part of the film. And then when we cut back to the mother, the first shot is just a shot out her window of that tree. And I instantly knew where I was because she had taken like the time to establish like the importance of the nature around them, like the specific trees, the specific views, and they're kind of ingrained into your mind so that you always know kind of where you are based on that.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite really of exoticizing a place, because she has such like she has so much care for the small details of the place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just I found the most beautiful place, I can look at it.
But like I also think about the sound, and because Shara is interesting because there's almost no dialogue in it, but there is a lot of sound, and there's like this sound of like chimes, and like sometimes it seems diegetic and sometimes it seems like a score. Mm-hmm. And it's this sort of sense of like time passing. It's also like really relaxing and hard not to like just be like, ah, yes, I'm calm and meditating and
Shara, the shots are so long.
Yeah.
Like you see the entire dance performance at the parade.
And you also like wind through the streets. You get to know their neighborhood through single shots.
And I mean, it's interesting that in Radiance that it's sort of about the impossibility of translating a visual medium into sound.
Mm.
Because her films are so evocative with the sound, like I would imagine that you would get a lot of the film's ideas just from listening to it.
Yeah, we need a film of someone trying to do audio description of a Naomi Kawase
film. That's so meta.
Come on, she has to do it. Make a documentary about it.
It's like writing the subtitles, the captions for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Radiance that made me think about this and about Kawase's films more generally is so something that Mina Shum said to us, which I think is on our tote bag, is that the visual should be able to tell the story with no sound, and the sound should be able to tell the story with no visuals.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I thought a lot about during Radiance and the idea of like what it is that she has to translate for this audience, and also something about Kawase's films more generally, because I think she's very attentive to both.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about men and the horrible things
that they write.
Why are men so mad at Naomi Kawase?
What did she do to them? I want to know.
We were talking, Ola, about how she described Still the Water as her masterpiece, and I was saying, I've never heard a female director describe their work as like a masterpiece. It feels like such a gendered thing to sort of to do that. You know, it's such a Quentin Tarantino thing of like putting it in the text of your film.
Yeah,
and I think she said that before it premiered.
She said it says on the Wikipedia, Kawase has described the film as her masterpiece, and it was before it premiered, deserving of the Palme d'Or, and states, "This is the first time that I have said this about a film. After the Camera d'Or and the Grand Prix, there is nothing I want more than the Palme d'Or. I have my eyes on nothing else."
I'm not sure she's saying she thinks it deserves it. That seems a questionable interpretation of that.
Yeah, and that wasn't in quotation marks. They had just implied that, which, yeah, I don't think is true, but... I admire the balls of saying that before your film's premiere and then leaving yourself open for people to make fun of it in their reviews, which they did. I love the film. Give it the... I mean, I would have been happy if they gave it the poem.
Better pick than Winter Sleep.
aptly named.
yes. Well, I think also it's, I mean, something that I learned, because that was, I mean, this happens to be the year that I discovered what the Cannes Film Festival was like, because it was the year that I went there for the first time. And I guess the thing that I didn't understand before I was actually there is how people are in such a rush to classify everything as a masterpiece or trash.
She got ahead of the game for them.
Yeah. And there's very little nuance. Like, I remember Mr. Turner premiered, and within, like, I saw it premiered at 8:30 a.m. I saw it at 3 p.m. that day. And by the time I saw it, it had already been declared a masterpiece. And I remember seeing Adam McGoyan's The Captive at the press, like the first press screening. At
a film that has stood the test of time.
And I remember coming out of it being like, that wasn't very good, but like, I enjoyed it. Like, his films are always kind of entertaining, even if they're bad.
Speaking of someone who gets to go to Cannes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh my god, anyway.
He used to be really good.
Yeah, there was a time.
Now he's just interesting.
Now he gives David Thewlis good roles.
That's right.
And nothing else.
But I remember walking out of that screening and people were like, it's the worst movie ever made. And I was like, did you see Grace of Monaco? Because that was a couple days ago.
Yeah. I mean, your point that Still the Water was being called the worst movie at Cannes the same year that Grace of Monaco was there is very apt, because that's a bad movie.
Yeah.
Still the Water is not.
And, like, part of the culture of Cannes is, like, critics want a punching bag. Like, every year they look for a punching bag that they can write really nasty reviews about. And, like, Still the Water just kind of seemed to be the lightning rod for that.
Well, you said something before we recorded about how it was interesting context that... because we have brought up the context of Jane Campion's statement, but we haven't really connected to why... how that related to this, like, masterpiece and then Pan's thing... and you talked about, like, I don't know, people's attempts to be faux woke by panning Naomi Kawase's film, which seems like a very odd way to go about that. But I know, how do you think the lore of, like, the Jane Campion statement fits in with how people reacted to this film?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, like one of the worst pieces that's been written about Naomi Kawase was in IndieWire, written by known abuser of women, Adam Cook. Not known at the time, but known now. And one of the things it says is, it's like, well, maybe they put her in competition so that, like, she wouldn't take attention away from the boys' club.
It's a false flag.
And...
they're picking the worst woman they can find so that it makes woman directors look bad, which is very unfair. Like, is Naomi Kawase the best woman director? I don't even know, but why does it have to be the one best woman director? Like, her films deserve
why
to
does
play.
Any film have to be the best film ever? Can't it just be a good film?
Yeah.
What a concept.
Well, and there was a lot of talk about how there were only two women in competition.
There are only two women. Full stop.
And the idea that, like, the conversation then turned to be like, why these two women, as though there were only ever two spots that could be reserved for women in competition. Like, it was,
do you remember what the other one was?
Yeah, it was The Wonders, the Alice Rohrwacher film, which won it won a prize. I think it won Grand Prix. And there was a lot of, like, well, Jane Campion's going to give, like, one of the women an award to make a point kind of, like, sentiment. People really did love The Wonders. I did not. Although I'll take that opinion with a grain of salt, because I didn't like Still the Water either and I was wrong.
But yeah, imagine having to give one of the two women a thing.
They can't possibly deserve it.
Both films that were very, like, about girlhood and about, like, being a girl.
What could be worse?
I mean, I don't want to watch that. The other thing, if they wonder why Kawase's at Cannes all the time, a lot of women have long breaks in between making films,
right?
Because of support.
Yeah.
Kawase makes a film every couple of years. Like, she...
yeah.
She has actually managed to secure a career that she can consistently be at work.
That's such
compared to, like, Deborah Granik.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I can't think we stated this before. The title of the article is, why does the Cannes Film Festival keep pro-roaring Naomi Kawase's movies? And I think one of the worst things about this...
and that
is
was
the
next
that,
year when Sweet Bean played.
Yeah, so it's a retrospective on, like, why did they program the terrible, awful movie Still the Water? And then now, why have they... they haven't even put Sweet Bean in competition. It was in a sidebar. But the worst thing about this is that after reading the whole piece, unfortunately, I realized, because there's a letter grade at the end, that it was a review of Sweet Bean. apparently. Like, this was like commissioned. This wasn't like a separate article that was commissioned about how awful Naomi Kawase is. It was a review of Sweet Bean that doesn't imply that in the title, because... I mean, the implication being that, like, it's not worth taking one of Naomi Kawase's films at face value and, like, assessing its independent worth as a piece of art.
Yeah.
Because they're just that bad. She's such a crime against cinema that I have to use this space of a review to explain why she should not be allowed to make a film ever.
Yeah, and, like, he has a lot of comments about how she made, like, she did things wrong, like, how dare she shoot this scene in the way she shot it? She should have shot it a different way. Like, thank you, 22-year-old white man.
And he does say, her latest efforts, by all accounts, a lesser offence, but no greater a piece of cinema, is a light and fluffy exercise in sheer sentimentality. The director's bid to make her version of a film in the style of fellow Cannes regular Hirokazu Koreeda, minus the rigorous formulism and plus a lot of schmaltz. So apparently he's just decided that she was trying to make a Koreeda film and not that they were both like contemporaries who have like plenty of differences in their filmmaking.
And I mean, that piece, our friend of the podcast, Lindsay Pugh, editor-in-chief of Woman in Revolt, she wrote a review of Sweet Bean in which there is like a hilarious takedown of this article where she very like aggressively uses sick because they used the wrong peak.
S-S-I-S-I-C.
Yeah, S-I-C. Because there's like copy, like egregious copy errors in this. And it just like, as bad as Adam Cook looks, it makes like Indie Wire almost look worse because, as other friend of the podcast, Angelo Moretta, would say, somebody edited this and somebody published it.
Yeah. And it's, I guess, slightly heartening to think that I think that if this piece was published now, people would like notice and be mad about it, the blatant sexism within it. So I hope like that's a good sign, maybe. Like, I don't think you could get away with the same kind of blatantly sexist criticisms of Kawase's film now. You can get away with more subtly sexist ones.
Well, and there were, like, the other one that Brett was sharing with us was the CinemaScope review, which was, like, I don't know what planet he's on, because he accuses her of being not concerned with film as a visual medium.
For Still the Water.
Like, I don't know how you come up with that for any of her films, but especially, like, Still the Water. I think somehow he ends up equating, like, she uses a handheld camera to she doesn't think about where the camera goes.
And I think what's really interesting is that that's false on many levels.
Yeah.
Because not only does she create beautiful images.
Yeah.
On like a grand scale, like poetic images, you know, the underwater images, the images of nature. I think the way that she shoots dialogue scenes are also like incredibly well thought out. Like in a way that actually sort of reduces the sentimentality, quote unquote, of them sometimes or mitigates it. Because like, I mean, there's a scene where the sun in Still the Water like completely blows up at his mother, and a more kind of like brash filmmaker might shoot this intense like screaming match because he's just screaming at her and she's sitting there silently, but like in a close-up of his face. But for the entire scene she just keeps the camera at a distance fixed on the face, or like pointed towards the face of the mother, who is silent, almost shooting this incredibly like emotional scene in a way that allows us to watch it from a bit of a remove, so it's not too in your face, which is something that people accuse her of being. I think you see those kind of like very smart choices of how to cover scenes, how to kind of shoot scenes in a single shot with like very interesting blocking throughout like all of her films. So she's a good visual filmmaker of dialogue scenes, of more traditional scenes, and of the big poetic images. So it just kind of baffles me where they get these comments from.
Yeah. Well, and I think she's especially really good and attentive to spaces, both domestic and otherwise. Like, I think what's really stunning in Shara is the way it opens on this room, which I think it's like a printing room. Is that what it is? Well, anyway, the opening scene of Shara is basically just a camera moving all around. The camera's just moving all around this room. Mm. And then this boy, his twin brother, goes missing. And then you start seeing the way this family exists in their house, but they're all separate. Like, they're never really in the same space. Even though they're in the same space, you see them moving around each other without actually being next to each other. Mm. And one of the key scenes for that is when the police officer comes and tell them that like they found, like this is like years later, they found the twin brother, and we watch the scene play out on like his brother's face, and we hear like the cop talking to somebody, and we realize that he's talking to the father, and eventually we realize that the father is downstairs and the son is upstairs, and they don't know that the son is listening. And I think our films are filled with these moments, like the way that we find out in Still the Water that the boy has like glimpsed his mother having sex with the man with the tattoo, and it's sort of like through a curtain curtain, and there's all these ways in which he and his mother live in the same space, but they are like ships passing in the night compared to the girl's family, where they, I mean, there's a lovely scene where she lies on her mother's lap, who lies on the father's lap, and then the father complains that he doesn't have anyone to lie on. And you see them really gathered in a way that is like a shared space. I just think she's attentive to spaces in the way that like Ozu was.
Yeah.
And I mean, she does the same thing too, I think, outdoors in the, like in the outdoor spaces as well. But I think she's just as gifted with like the production design and the way she shows her characters moving through their homes and the way those homes are designed. Like in True Mothers, the apartment where the couple live, there's something about that where there aren't hidden spaces and there's nowhere to sort of like hide from each other. Like they just have this long hallway and there's a way, so they're always together in the same, in the main room. You don't see them passing each other. And that gives them a sort of togetherness that characters in her other films don't have.
Mm. I'm very curious how True Mothers would have been received if it had premiered at Cannes, because it is a bit different from her other films. It's less focused on kind of poetic imagery and more on story. And I imagine that it might have been a film, I mean, I think it got a good reception at TIFF, and the Cannes audiences are very different from TIFF audiences. But I like to think that possibly it would like have been more favorably received than some of her earlier work.
I think Cannes is also just like generally a very sexist place. Like the majority of critics there are men. I mean, even the films that are about women, they tend to be directed. Like, I'm not saying that there aren't thoughtful films there or good films. Like, there definitely are. And like, you know, some of our favorite directors have had films at Cannes who are women and about women. But like, there's a degree to which, you know, like Portrait of a Lady on Fire played Cannes, and like people didn't immediately jump to it's a masterpiece. Like people liked it a lot, you know, but it wasn't.
It won the screenplay prize.
Yeah, but you could imagine like if it was not, if it was directed by like a man, or if it like wasn't about two women falling in love, that like, you know, I mean,
it probably would have won more than the screenplay prize.
The Kashish film won the Palme d'Or. What was, Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yeah,
right.
Don't get me started on that.
Yeah, which, you know, like whatever, he abused the actors on that, so yeah. So I don't know, like I feel like Cannes also, I mean, Cannes is a perfect storm of all kinds of horrible things too. Like, you wait in line for 2 hours to see a movie. So by the time you get in, you're hungry, dehydrated, sweating, and sitting next to other people who are sweating in a cinema that is like 25 degrees Celsius when it's empty.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's full of like 1,000 sweaty people who are just standing outside in the hot sun and are also like dehydrated and hungry. So then they're like, so they either want to pan a film or say it's like a masterpiece, because otherwise, was it worth the misery of going to the screening?
Right.
And then there's a hurry to have like the first take. So then you get these really unnuanced takes. And within a day, there's a consensus on a film, and films get buried or elevated within 24 hours.
Mm. Yeah. And I think, I mean, that doesn't do favors to someone like, as we've talked about, I think her films are all interesting, even if they're not all great.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is not something the Cannes environment necessarily like nurtures.
And I think they require patience and like time to sit with, in a way that I imagine like that kind of environment just is not, you know, conducive to.
No, and like there's a press lounge office, I don't know what to call it. It's like a room with a bunch of tables, and where like you see everybody goes there after the screening, and you see the person sitting next to you like write and file their review within an hour of the screening. Sometimes somebody who left the screening 10 minutes early, Peter Howell.
I think she is a super, super interesting filmmaker.
Yeah.
And like watching these all in a week has been super gratifying, I think. And I really hope, like, it almost feels a shame. I feel like if Naomi Kawase started making films now, perhaps the narrative about her career wouldn't follow the same course.
Yeah.
Because she really was sort of like, I don't know, ahead of her time, I guess. And like, for example, a new filmmaker on the scene now is Chloe Zhao, who makes also films that really prioritize nature in a kind of similar way to Naomi Kawase's films. They're very sort of like romantic films, they're sentimental films, and they have beautiful shots of landscapes. And actually, I mean, Alex and I are not huge fans of Nomadland, and we think it's almost like too romanticized. So it's funny that that Chloe Zhao is being very widely embraced now, yeah. whereas Naomi Kawase, whose films are sort of less romanticized in their depictions of stuff like class, for example, which is quite like smartly dealt with in a bunch of her films, like Two Mothers, for example, in a way that something like Nomadland doesn't necessarily do. But Chloe Zhao as a new filmmaker has been embraced, and Naomi Kawase, it feels like because she sort of, you know, went through that process of being trashed, she now has that on her name permanently, and it's going to be very difficult to like shed the label of being like that filmmaker who makes schmaltzy over sentimental films mm-hmm. when she's not really doing that. And I mean, I hope for a kind of narrative change and a reappraisal of her work mm-hmm. and also for it to be
available.
Kind of, yeah, because yes. I mean, think about it, like a lot of filmmakers working in the same kind of time as her have had their films like re-released on box sets. They've had retrospectives, and she hasn't had that treatment, and she hasn't had that opportunity for a reappraisal. And I really hope that comes soon. I feel like she's like absolutely overdue it. She's made so many films, first of all, and she's made so many films that like were misconstrued and deserve revisiting. I mean, I think Alex is living proof of that, because you went back and watch Still the Water again and liked it a lot more.
Mm. Well, and I also think she's someone you kind of have to take on her own terms. I think it doesn't mm-hmm. help to see her films out of context. I mean, almost in a way, like the difference between her and Chloe Zhao is that Chloe Zhao makes films that are not about her home, that are not about a land that she knows. And so they have a sort of outsider's eye and a romantic view of this landscape, and that it means a lot to the characters in the film, but you almost see it more from an outsider's awe than like what it would be to just live there.
But Naomi Kawase is exoticizing Japan.
Yeah, she got accused of that in multiple reviews, including like one by a woman in Variety, I think, for Still the Water. And I think what she does is the opposite, is she sort of takes time to, well, like you said, she's from there, but it's like she takes time to notice the things about the land. And if anything, it reminds me more of the way indigenous people actually shoot the land, like as a thing that is living, that you know well, that is essential to the place, to the people, that there's a kinship and a relationship to the land.
There's it shot with like love and familiarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that it's part of the land, and the story of the land is as much the story as the people. And, you know, like it reminds, and her attentiveness to sound kind of reminds me of, you know, like the sound of the snow in Falls Around Her, or the way that you can always hear the ocean in Monkey Beach, unlike Trickster, whereas Brett put it on our episode on that. It just regularly forgets that it's supposed to be by the ocean. Like, there's a real and the way she shoots forest, I don't know, like when I see that, I think, oh, this kind of reminds me of how I feel when I watch indigenous film.
No, I thought that too as well, especially because we've like spent a lot of time in the last couple of years like interviewing indigenous filmmakers, and they're talking about how to shoot the land and create the sounds of the land. And it did make me think of that, like absolutely watching her films. Like there's such a sense of place. Mm-hmm. The place is so tied to the stories. It couldn't just take place anywhere.
And I think, like, you really have to understand that that's part of her storytelling, because I think the mistake I had when I went into Still the Waters, I didn't know anything about her filmmaking or her preoccupations. So I kind of went in wanting or expecting a certain kind of film. And then when I didn't get that, I was like, oh, well, I didn't like it, which I think is what, you know, I mean, we've talked about this before. Like, that's how people responded to Louder Than Bombs at Cannes. They were like, there was no big cathartic moment. Nothing happened. Well,
and that's also a film that I think people are accused of, like, schmaltziness, just because it dealt with emotions.
Yeah, yes.
Imagine accusing an Isabelle Huppert movie of schmaltziness.
Well, and that like it didn't have a screaming match, so it couldn't be a real drama. Like nothing happened in that film, which is also like, you know, people also accuse like Kawase's films of nothing happening. But I think it's all very subtle, and you have to kind of go in with the understanding that you have to watch the ocean and the way that she uses the ocean and the leaves and the sounds, that this is all part of immersing you in the world and the headspace of the characters. And that part of the character development is like the land development almost. Like, I think there's a lot in Still the Water, especially about the way that the girl is very tied to the land and she's connected to it. And that's partly in the way that she like goes swimming in the sea, and the way that the boy feels alienated from it, like he's afraid of the sea. And then he's sort of a city boy and he doesn't want to slaughter the goat. And there's
also
a way
saw which... criticism that her films are not political. And I was like,
she's very like purposeful in picking subject matter that's like sort of that is inherently political.
It's like her films are all kind of about this like rural urban divide and the kind of tradition versus modernity thing,
and yeah, women's and lives like, it's like yeah. They're actually pretty incendiary.
Yeah, and she's like talked about like disability and yeah. People who are pariahs in society, and like her subject matter just is it just is political. Like I read that. I can't remember what review that was in, but like
I think it might even be on our Wikipedia
yeah,
article.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because
oh, it is. Yeah,
that's mad. All art is inherently political, but you know that it's just.
But I do think that like when you see her films together, you have a different experience of them. Like I could see watching Radiance on its own and being like, well, that was really interesting about translation, and then it kind of turned into a bad love story, and so it wasn't very good.
Yeah,
and like it's not. Untrue, but I guess I think it's more interesting in the context of her work, because you think about how she is interested in sound and images, and then that kind of makes you think about also how she uses sound and image in that film, whereas I could see if you were more focused on like, oh, and these characters are diametrically opposed and they're going to fall in love, and then you're like, well, but the love story is kind of unsatisfying, but it's kind of like, but that's, it's kind of more of an excuse than what the film is about.
Yeah, I mean, I had an interesting experience watching Still the Water, because I really didn't know much about the film going into it, and so I just started it. I watched the first hour, I loved it, and then I had to pause it because I had like scheduled a Zoom meeting. Then in between that, like we were talking on Slack about like how it had been critically panned. And I started reading up about it, and because as I had been watching it, I was loving it so much. I was like, oh, did this win awards at Cannes? This must have been really loved at Cannes, because this movie's really good. And then I read up about it, and it was so interesting how, and it made me think about how, like we mentioned the thing of her calling it her masterpiece before, which is like to explicitly make the connection of like, I think that it's interesting that her saying that probably damaged the trajectory of the film significantly. Because like Millie, you were saying that it's rare that we see women talking about their films like that. And that's so true. And I think that it's considered like almost like offensive to people that she would dare say that about her own film. Like, but as you said, like Quentin Tarantino literally like ended one of his films with the line, I think this is my masterpiece. And then it was nominated for an Oscar. But, like, I think people were, like, they took it as a challenge to dislike the film that she said that.
I mean, it may be worthwhile pointing out that this is also... Girls started in 2012, and when Hannah called herself the voice of a generation, people decided that that meant Lena Dunham thought she was the voice of a generation. And they, like, missed the fact that the show does a lot of making fun of Hannah. But they were just like, well, how dare a woman think she's the voice of a generation? Which, like, first of all, nobody thinks Hannah is the voice of a generation. Not like anybody involved with the show except Hannah, who is too busy, who's got her nose in her
and
navel.
Also a fictional character.
Yeah, but like they're like, I just feel like that's maybe an important context, that like the idea of a woman declaring her importance was so, what's the word I'm looking, like
unacceptable.
Yeah. And like, also, I think maybe it's a difference. There's a difference between saying your film is a masterpiece versus your masterpiece, which.
Yeah, I think for her, it seems like it's a film that's very important to her. And I think it is a film that like brings together a lot of her preoccupations in a very grandiose way. Yeah. I can see why she'd think that about it. And it's actually probably my favorite of her films. So, I mean, it just makes sense as a statement. Like, she's allowed to think that.
Yeah.
She's not saying it is the masterpiece of the Cannes Film Festival.
Well,
also, 2014.
Who knows, like, what the translation was. I mean, something that's interesting, this is a slight tangent, but something that I did notice at Cannes, and that I think was especially, like, it's especially true of films that are, like, not not Indo-European. Well, at Cannes, they have subtitles in English and in French. And as someone who speaks both languages, I would actually often read the French ones because the English ones are lower down. And if there's a head blocking them, you can't see them, whereas the French ones are burnt into the screen. But when you watch like a Kawase film or you watch like a Japanese film, I would read the French and the English subtitles and they would be completely different.
Interesting.
And I would always be like, I really wonder what I'm missing. Because it's like the rare chance where you actually can see simultaneous subtitles in different languages. Mm-hmm. And they would usually be relatively sparse. So like you did have time to read both. And I would read both and be like, well, these are not overlapping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, words really do have different meanings in different languages. And you know, who knew? I imagine And the word masterpiece or like however it was translated probably has different connotations in different cultures. Yes. It's obviously not something people think about when they have a headline grabbing line. But yeah, I mean, it's probably a good note to end on is the idea of like you talking about it being very taboo for a woman to declare her importance, which I mean, I think she is incredibly important. Like she's an incredibly significant filmmaker. We were talking about how she's like one of the only sort of lauded Japanese female filmmakers and was sort of trailblazing in that regard. And she was even doing interesting things in documentary. Like I read an interview with her from Film Comment about her documentary work where she said at the time she was making documentaries about herself and many critics told her that they didn't count as documentaries because they're about herself.
Wow.
And she was like, oh, well, I wasn't trying to push the medium in a different direction. I was just making the films I wanted to make, but people were telling me that they didn't count. And I think in many respects, she is like, whether you like her films or not, she is an incredibly significant filmmaker. Mm. And she I don't think it's a terrible thing that she's aware of that.
Yeah, and I think the question is not why does Cannes keep programming Naomi Kawase? The question is why hasn't Cannes programmed Alice Winokur in their competition? I mean, they have programmed Alice Winokur, but not in competition. And why haven't they programmed Almaya Tailfeathers and Kathleen Hepburn or, Deborah? I mean, I guess Deborah Granik's played in Director's Fortnight, but she hasn't been in competition, I don't think. Or why haven't they programmed Joanna Hogg? Like there's so many amazing women directors and they regularly ignore them or shove them into South Town Aga, which is not a bad place to be, but it is kind of considered second tier. Yeah. It's basically
from a completely practical perspective, a lot of critics won't see the films in Unsound Regard because they go there and they watch the competition film. So your film is just not going to get as many eyes on it.
Yeah.
So it really does matter.
Yeah.
Mm. I did want to read a quote that I really liked from our friend Lindsay Pugh.
Yeah.
A regular guest of the podcast. Not from her review, but from her interview with Kieran Kiki, who is in Sweet Bean. And I think she's in another Kawase film, but I can't remember which one, but not in as big a role. But she's in Sweet Bean, and Lindsay, it wasn't an interview for Sweet Bean, but Lindsay went out of her way to ask about Kawase. And she asked, I read somewhere that Naomi Kawase doesn't watch many Japanese films, which I found surprising. And Kieran Kiki says, I just heard that for the first time too, and I'm surprised. And Lindsay says, yeah, I was shocked by it. I wonder what she watches. And Kieran Kiki says, she doesn't necessarily say anything bad about other people's work, but to her, she's number one, the best of the best. She's often disliked because of this. And you know what? Good for her.
I think a lot of directors think that way. They just don't necessarily say it.
That has been our episode on Naomi Kawase. Thank you so much for listening. As I mentioned at the opening, we actually have a fifth episode coming out next week in which we will be talking about Naomi Kawase's Tokyo Olympics films, amongst other things. It's an episode on Cannes 2022 as a whole. We'll be talking about some of the sidebar films by women that we managed to see remotely. And we'll also be airing Cannes Dirty Laundry and talking about all the very questionable things that they did this year and how women at Cannes fared in 2022. So check in with us next Wednesday for that. In the meantime, if you haven't yet, I'd encourage you to listen to episodes 1 through 3. of this series about the history of women at Cannes, Celine Sciamma and Kelly Reichardt. And I'd encourage you to discover our ebooks about three great women directors whose work has been programmed at the Cannes competition: Lynn Ramsey, Celine Sciamma and Kelly Reichardt. And you can get our books on those filmmakers in a box set, the Women in the Cannes competition box set, at 7th-row.com/womenatcannesboxset. Thank you very much for listening. Please rate and review and spread the word about this episode and about the series as a whole. We would really, really, really appreciate it. We have been trying to get the word out there about this series and about the conversation that we're trying to facilitate about the structural failings of the Cannes Film Festival, because they are many. You can also contact us with a longer missive at contact@7th-row.com, and we really would love to hear from you. It really makes a day when people reach out. I hope to see you next week, and thank you for listening.